Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Lee Young Lee. Lee Young was born in 1957 in Jakarta, Indonesia, of Chinese parents. His father was a personal physician to Mao Zedong while in China, and he relocated his family to Indonesia in 1949. In 1959, the Lee family fled the country to escape anti-Chinese sentiment, and after a five-year trek through Hong Kong, Macau, and Japan, they settled in the United States in 1964. Lee Young Lee attended the universities of Pittsburgh in Arizona and the State University of New York at Brockport. He has taught at several universities, including Northwestern and the University of Iowa. He is the author of three books of poetry, Book of My Nights, published in 2001, The City in Which I Love You, published in 1991, and Rose, published in 1986. He's received various awards for the books. The 1990 edition of The City in Which I Love You received the Lamont Poetry Selection, and Rose won the Delmore Schwartz Memorial Poetry Award. He's also written a memoir entitled The Winged Seed, A Remembrance, published in 1995, which received an American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Other honors include a Lannan Literary Award, a Whiting Writers Award, grants from the Illinois Arts Council, the National Endowment of the Arts, and a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship. Lee Young lives in Chicago, Illinois, with his wife Donna and his two sons. Lee Young, welcome.
Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you for being here. I wanted to begin by asking you, what brought you to writing?
I did grow up with poetry being recited in my home. My parents were both classically educated in China, which meant they could recite hundreds of ancient Chinese poems and long passages from, you know, the philosophical texts like Zhuangzi and Laozi and Mozu. So I grew up listening to that, and my father was a minister, which meant he read out loud from the Bible and the King James Bible. And so I grew up with that kind of language in the mm-hmm. house, you know. And, you know, when I was a kid, Shauna, it seems to me that my experience of the world was somehow that it was charged with a kind of superabundance of being and presence. I mean, like trees and clouds and rocks and the river I walked beside on my way to school, that kind of thing. That everything seemed so alive and full of being. And when I heard poetry, it seemed to me that that was the condition of language that approximated my experience of the world the most. Of course, this is all in retrospect, but I think I couldn't see the difference between poetry and my experience of the world, you know, that poetry was the condition of language that was the most charged with being and presence, and that was my experience of the world. And I guess I just wanted to partake of that. And then when I started learning the English language, I found the language so exotic. It's kind of strange, you know, because it was so other to me. Uh-huh. And it was so interesting that way. And I guess that must have contributed to my wanting to write.
Do you ever write in Chinese?
You know, I haven't been able to write in Chinese since I was about 9 years old. My mother was able to keep us reading and writing up until I was about nine. I can still speak it and understand it, but I'm losing that very quickly. But no, I can't read or write anymore. I can still write my name, you know, but that's about it.
I have a picture of you from a reading that I heard you say afterwards that you wrote most of the poems. I think this is right when Book of My Nights came out, or Poem of My Nights, sorry. And you talked about writing up in your attic late at night, sleepless. And so I always have this picture of you sort of huddled by an attic window writing. Is that accurate
no,
at all?
Well, it's kind of accurate. You know, I live in a big house with my siblings and all their families. We live like old-time China, you know. My sister and her family and my mother live on the first floor, and my brother and his family live on the second floor, and we live in kind of the attic. So I'm an insomniac, so I write mostly at night, you know. And it's almost a cliche. I'm a little embarrassed, but it's true.
Up in the garret.
Yeah, right.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about your writing process? I mean, do ideas come to you in full phrases? Is it words? Is it images? How do you begin?
Yeah, all of that, Shauna. Sometimes it's phrases. Sometimes it's their whole poems. Sometimes it's images. But, you know, Shauna, I've been thinking about this, and it dawns on me that ultimately, I think when we look at anything or any event, for instance, you and I talking here together, for us to ask ourselves how this event happened, we'd have to account for the engineer and the people who run the lights and your parents and my parents. And we'd have to, just to account for this one event of our being here together, we'd have to account for the inventor of microphones, the inventor of radio. I mean, it would just go on and on and on, you know, the food we ate, the coffee we drank, I mean, to make this conversation possible. So it seems to me that any event or anything resides, and when we look at it rigorously enough, everything and every event resides at a kind of center of a mandala of what I think of as the totality of causes. There are hundreds, thousands, even millions of things that have to come into play to make anything happen or any event. And it seems to me that a poem is the same thing. And every time I open myself up to that condition of the totality of causes, then poems happen. So I don't even know where the poem, like what exactly makes the poem happen, you know, because a lot of times the thing that makes the poem, that is the catalyst of the poem, eventually gets kicked out of the poem, you know. As I'm sitting there at night, it might be the morning dove outside the window, or it might be my kids breathing in the other room, or, you know, the piece of roast beef I had for dinner. I don't know what it is that comes into play, you know, that makes the poem happen. But I know that if I'm open to that condition of everything coming into play, the chances of a poem happening are greater. And so I would say that the poem, a poem, is the locally inflected voice of the all. So, as long as I'm able to open myself up to that condition, it seems that it happens. Yeah.
And when you say the all, are you meaning the divine, the universe, the totality of events, all of the above?
Yeah, all of the above. Imagination, memory, you know, our psychology, all of our past, our present, our hopes for the future, the condition of our bodies at the moment we're writing, you know, the immediate conditions around us, you know, all of that, you know, all of who we are comes to bear on the poem. And it's such a mystery to me. So that's why I'm convinced too, Shauna, that somehow poetic consciousness is the closest thing we have to something like total consciousness. Not that it's ever total, you know, but it's, I think the practice of art is a way to approach that, you know, so.
When you were speaking, I sort of got a picture of the poem or the act of writing the poem as a spider's web that catches all of the things that are happening at one time.
Yes. Yeah, I do think that kind of, irradiating thing of the spider's web is.
You write a lot about time and about memory. Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about your conception of time, which I think is different than the way most people tend to think about it?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have any bright conceptions. I know that my experience of time is both continuous and discontinuous. But, you know, ultimately, I think it's the experience of my own consciousness, because my own consciousness feels continuous and discontinuous, right? I mean, I will be thinking about something, and suddenly I'll be thinking about something else, and I don't even know when I stopped thinking about the, you know, I notice that when I'm working on a poem, that my mind wanders, and my experience of time is exactly coincident with my experience of my own consciousness. So, and somehow the poem, looking at poems is a way to study, I guess, time and consciousness, because you know, poems have continuity and discontinuity, you know, stanza breaks and so on. And yet it's a continuous voice speaking throughout, you know. You know, I really do think, Shauna, as crazy as it may sound, that the study of poetry is basically the study of being and psyche and spirit and soma and consciousness, you know, because ultimately a poem is made in the image of the maker. So to study a poem would be to study psyche. Mm-hmm. And since psyche is a descendant of nature, so when we study psyche, I guess we're studying the really deep laws of nature, and nature is a descendant of the cosmos. So to study poetry is to study the cosmos, you know.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is poet Lee Young Lee. Lee Young, when you talk about the study of poetry, do you engage yourself in, or let me rephrase that, how do you engage in the study of poetry for yourself as a poet?
Well, for me, it's close reading of poems, you know, and then I love just taking the time to read poems closely, and I just derive great pleasure thinking about poems, you know, and the nature of poems and the nature of speech. If you think about it, Sean, a poem is a score for human speech. It's like a musical score.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, you can have a score to play violin or something like that. A poem is a score for the human voice. It's for speech. And when we think about the nature of speech, it's a very interesting and predicament, because the fact of the matter is all speech is done with the exhaled breath. And if you think about it, it's interesting and complicated, because when we breathe in, when we inhale, our bodies, the sense of an I, mm-hmm. is really affirmed. You know, we breathe in, our bodies are very comfortable, our blood is filled with nutrients. There's scientific proof, in fact, that our bones actually get very hard and our muscles get very toned when we inhale. But when we inhale, we do so in silence. We can't talk. That is, we can't make verbal meaning and breathe in at the same time. So we can't create verbal meaning and affirm the sense of an I simultaneously. But when we breathe out, life begins to leave our bodies. Nutrients mm-hmm. leave the bloodstream, and our bones actually get softer. And if you breathe out to capacity, you'll start to feel a little woozy, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, the sense of an I is undermined. But verbal meaning is only possible exhaling. So verbal meaning can only be made at the cost of the sense of an I. So we can only make verbal meaning when we displace, what do you want to call it, the ego?
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird reality to me.
So when you think of creating a piece of art or mm-hmm. a poem in this sense, or a song, you're giving up the ego in order to create something that is completely yourself?
Right. That's really...
a paradox.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, strange and wonderful to me. And yet it's full of... for me, a kind of anxiety, because for instance, the more I talk, okay, the more I say, the more my meaning gets disclosed. So meaning increases. The more I say, the more my meaning gets disclosed. But the more I say, the more my vitality decreases.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning increases in opposite ratio to vitality. So why is there this exchange of presences? Like vitality, the presence of the ego, the body, I, has to be exchanged in order to make meaning, to make verbal meaning. And there's always this exchange of presences going on in the poems, I think. I think because when you're writing a poem, ultimately, it's not your own will that writes the poem. It's something else. We'll call it the unconscious, call it the divine, call it whatever. Call it your demon, whatever, you know. But there's always this exchange of presences. You know, the ancient mm-hmm. poets... in the Western tradition, they always said, sing muses.
Right.
They opened all their epic poems with that. So they never thought that a human being was saying the poem. They always thought that the muses were singing through them. So immediately there's an exchange of presence, right? The human presence for the muse. And that actually goes on all the time when we talk. And so that speech is a paradigm for living itself, right? Because as we die, as the vitality of our bodies decreases, the meaning of our lives gets more and more disclosed. So speech itself is a paradigm for human living.
Mm-hmm.
And we participate in this paradigm on a large scale of our lives, and we participate it on smaller scales when we talk. And that must be the paradigm on a cosmic scale, too. And does this make sense?
Yes. And, actually, it's making very good sense.
Yeah, so it seems to me that maybe poets are people who can't stand the almost tragic predicament of this exchange of presences. And so what they do is they try to ransom the dying breath by packing the utterance with as much meaning as possible. Psychic meaning, intellect, feeling, eros, passion, all of it, you know. And so as a result, the best poems become saturated with being. But that being is somehow above and beyond and deeper than the ego being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a mystery to me.
It is. And, you know, I think this would be a great time to hear one of your poems or two of your poems if you would like to read that. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is Lee Young Lee. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and we're going to hear Lee Young read a few of his new poems.
Yeah. My favorite place in Chicago, it's a train station, Union Station.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a train there, you know, it's called the 20th Century. And I love sitting there and listening to the announcements, you know. They say, your attention, please.
Yes.
The 20th century is about to arrive. You know? The 20th century has just departed, and I love that. And this poem's called Station. Your attention, please. Train number 9, the Northern Zephyr, destined for River's End, is now boarding. All ticketed passengers, please proceed to the gate marked Evening. Your attention, please. Train number 7, leaves blown by, bound for the color of thinking and renovated time, is now departing. All ticketed passengers may board behind my eyes. Your attention, please. Train number 4, the 20th century, has joined the wind undisguised to become the written word. Those who never heard their names may inquire at the uneven margin of this story, or else consult the ivy lying awake under our open window. Your attention, please. The music, arriving out of hidden ground and endlessly beginning, is now the flower, now the fruit, now our cup and cheer under branches more ancient than our grandmother's hair. Passengers with memories of the sea may board leisurely at any unmarked gate. Fateful members of the foam may proceed to Azalea. Your attention, please. Under falling petals, never think about home. Seeing begins in the dark. Listening stills us. Yesterday has gone ahead to meet you. All light-bearing tears may be exchanged for the accomplished wine. Your attention, please. Train number 66, unbidden song, soon to be the full heart's quiet, takes no passengers. Please leave your baggage with the attendant at the window marked Your Name Sprung from Hiding. An intrepid perfume is waging our rescue. You may board at either end of childhood.
That was a new poem, Station, by Lee Young Lee. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, thank you.
I love your attention, please, because just as I was falling into an image, it pulled me back again, and I would fall, and it would pull me back again. So the rhythm was really quite wonderful, almost like a train in some ways.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Do you want to talk any about how you came to write that? Did it just pour out of you? Had you been in Union Station? Were you just remembering it? Or?
Yeah, well, I was spending a lot of time there. I would go there every morning and have my coffee on my way to work, you know, and I just loved sitting there in that big hall. And that was one of the train stations we came through when we first came to America. And I love train stations, of course. They're places of transition and places of continuity and discontinuity. So it's kind of like, mind. It's like sitting inside somebody's mind, you know, because there's the idea of time, you know, passing, trains passing, and the thoughts getting on and off, or passengers getting on and off. Well, thoughts getting on and off, I guess, you know. Yeah, so the whole feeling of transitions and destinations and origins, that whole thing is just, it seems to me, a microcosm of our condition, you know.
While you're talking about train stations, I couldn't help but remember a scene in The Winged Seed that your mom is giving to a young woman and her baby sugar cookies. She had nothing, young woman had nothing to eat, and your mom was showing her how to crumble them up. It was an incredibly touching scene. And I wonder if you, shifting away from poetry just for a moment, what took you to deciding to write a memoir in, I guess, a prose form? I mean, it's very poetic, but in a prose form.
Yeah, I was stupid enough to think, you know, I'd never written a prose poem. So I thought, I'm going to write a book-length prose poem. And at that point in my writing life, I somehow felt that there was a lot of psychological content I needed to assimilate or integrate, you know, and unseal. I felt as if there were a lot of things that were sealed in my heart, in my head, in my soul, and I had to find a way to unseal them. And I thought somehow that something verging on automatic writing would help me. So my ambition was to just blacken the page with as many words as possible, without much editing. You know, I was going through that phase, I think, in my writing where I thought that any revision was a betrayal of the integrity of the moment of composition, you know. So that whole thing was just unrevised. And I'm ashamed of it. I haven't even had the courage, really, to go back and read it completely, because I'm trying to take a breath and go back and revise the whole thing, you know. So it feels to me like one big lump of coal that I just dug out of myself and kind of, you know, plastered on the page. And
what's interesting to me as a reader is I have a very different sense of it than you do as a writer, because for me it was like one long breath. I mean, it was like a long exhale of, here's my life, I'm going to push it out. But it carried me with it in a way that you as a writer don't seem to have the same sense of.
So I'm sort of curious. Thank you, Shana. I don't believe that anymore, you know, the thing about
revision.
Yeah, about revision. You know, it's a necessary and even beautiful, enjoyable part of the process. I think what happens is the mind, I discovered that the mind functions, it has two capacities, at the risk of oversimplifying. The mind integrates, but it also differentiates. But at that moment in the time of my writing life, I was just obsessed with the idea of integrating more material. And there was a lot of painful material, I think, from my own personal history, from my parents' histories. And just even beyond my personal history, there was I kept sensing there was something past, something beyond my personal history that I needed to get to. So I was obsessed both with my personal origin and with the origin of reality itself. Mm-hmm. You know, I somehow had conflated my search for my personal origins with my need to understand the origins of reality. So I conflated those two, you know, desires in that one project. And And so I wanted to know what it would be like to speak from the condition, a very liminal condition, a condition of between consciousness and unconsciousness, you know, to speak completely from that place where meaning actually is born, meaning actually gets made, to speak beyond the editing self, you know. And so a lot of that writing was written in a trance or unconsciousness, or I don't know what to call it, you know.
It carried a very much of a sense of the diaspora, of being taken away from where one should have been and being relocated and trying to come to grips with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's...
I'm glad, Shana. You know, I keep thinking that maybe that whole thing is a kind of... that's paradigmatic, it seems to me, of consciousness being kicked out of unconsciousness, you know, of trying to find its source again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do think that poetry is speech that is aware of its own source, right? I mean, because there's so much silence in poetry. So I'm sometimes convinced that the real medium in poetry isn't even language, it's silence. And poetry is just a way to use language in order to inflect the deepest silences, the silences of our origins, the silences of, you know, of that condition of allness, you know, the roar of that condition. That roar would be a kind of deafening silence. But that's paradoxical. I don't know what I mean by that.
Speaking of paradoxes... Mm-hmm. You talk both about the difficulty of remembering whilst trying to stay in the present at the same time, that, you know, that in order to hear a poem, you have to be totally in the present.
Right.
And yet so much of your poetry deals in the realm of memory.
Yeah. There's that exchange of presences again. You know, Shana, it drives me crazy. I feel as if at this point in my life, my sense is that that's just the way things are going to be. There's always an exchange of presence, you know, that the human figure, if the human figure is very large, then the divine source of that human figure is going to be pushed into the background. But if the divine source looms very large, then the human figure is almost shattered or is threatened, you know? It would be like, I always think about this, it's my favorite image is Jacob wrestling the angel, right? After Jacob wrestles the angel, his name is changed from Jacob, that is a single human being, to Israel. I would guess that implies that he's been enhanced, he's been enlarged, because Israel is the name of a people. He's been expanded, deepened, enhanced. But then we have to remember that that agent of God puts his hand on Jacob's hip and Jacob is crippled. So any encounter with the divine both enhances the human by enlarging him or her, deepening them, but at the same time crippling them. So that exchange of, do you know what I mean? It's very interesting. In the case of Emily Dickinson, we see she was absolutely a demonized speaker. The speaker in those poems is speaking from a very mysterious condition of, I don't know, I feel like when I read Emily Dickinson, she has integrated a lot of psychic material that is even beyond the personal. But as we can see in Dickinson, even her syntax is shattered, so that the human figure is both shattered and yet deepened. And why is that so necessary? I guess I'm saying, why can't we have it both ways? Why is there's always this exchange between, you know, as soon as the divine looms large, then the human figure is threatened and shattered, but at the same time enhanced, right? Like in the case of Whitman, we have a very, the voice in Whitman's poems is not, it's not human scale the way we think of a social being, right? It's larger, it's cosmic. And as a result, I think the voice in those poems is subvocal. It's beyond, you know, larger than the social voice.
But sometimes can't that very human voice, I'm thinking of some of Lorca's stuff, I'm thinking some of Mary Oliver's stuff, that very human, daily, tangible voice capture the divine in a way that it inverts it the other way, so that as the human becomes bigger, the divine becomes even larger?
That would be my hope, you know, that would be my hope. But for instance, in the case of Lorca, I mean, he even talks about that, right, Sean? He's demonized by the duende.
Right.
And he talks about that. He says, in that essay, I think he even says, you wrestle the duende. The duende, it nearly kills you. You know, and we see in those brilliant metaphors, right, in order to get to those brilliant metaphors, what the, I mean, those poems of his, I don't hear a social voice. I hear a voice bigger and deeper than, you know, am I making sense, Sean, about
yes.
the social being?
Yes.
You know how a social being is, you know.
You're talking also about the, it, to quote you from another interview, you talked about a horizontal dialogue with culture in another
right.
interview that I read, which is the dialogue with the everyday, with the mundane. Let me let you explain it better than me.
Well, it just seems to me, I think poets all know this, that writing poems is a triaxial state of affairs, right? There's the poet, then there's the poet's divinity, the daemon, the Greeks called it, you know, which is a vertical condition. I mean, depending on where your daemon is, like for instance, in the case of Rilke, his daemon was below him. He says that. He says, my God is dark and below, you know. In the case of Dickinson, her God was above her. So, but it's a vertical state of affairs. The audience is a horizontal state of affairs. The audience witnesses this daemonization or divinization of the speaker. And by that witness, I mean, I think that's the service that a poet provides the culture. It's almost shamanistic, I guess, right? It's the affirmation that of our complete psychic and cosmic inheritance, that we're not just, that when we say human being, we're not just talking about the socially constructed being, you know, that is horizontal between, you know, one social unit and another social unit, that there are aspects of the human that verge on the divine, on the cosmic, you know, and that to me is a completely interior or vertical state of affairs. And it seems to me that poetry is the language divinized or opened to that condition, you know. So I think in the case of Lorca, I think he was integrating a lot of very deep psychic material, you know. That's what a metaphor is. A metaphor isn't a literary device, you know. It isn't like taking it's you know, people think it's just taking two words and finding an interesting way to deal with them. I think it's taking two psychic contents and marrying them, you know, because words refer to psychic contents in, you know, in our heads. And so when we marry them well, then you have a successful metaphor. And somebody like Lorca, who was so brilliant with that, I think he was integrating a lot of deep, deep, deep stuff. And so my sense is that that's the great thing about the practice of poetry. And because poetry is about speech or the voice, it exists between the body and the mind, right? So it's between psyche and soma. So it's right in that liminal stage. It's not like dance, it's all in the body. And it's not like philosophy, it's all in the mind. It's somewhere in between. You know, it's a human voice.
Do you think there are other art forms that are also in between in the same way that poetry is?
Oh, I'm sure there are. You know, I'm sure there are. I'm sure like even painting, right? It, because it has retinal effects on your eyes. And we know that eye cells come from brain cells. So that must, I think that's what art does. You know, I think all art forms are ultimately
that place in between.
Yeah, yeah.
I think this is a good time to ask you to read another poem, if you would.
Okay.
We're listening to Profiles. Our guest is Lee Young Lee, and I'm your host, Shauna Ritter.
Maybe I'll read a love poem, Shauna. I'm working on this. I don't have a title for it yet.
Thank you for sharing something that's in progress. Right. Appreciate it.
So I don't know what this is called. I think my problem is I always conflate the earthly, actual, physical beloved for God, you know, leads to big problems in my and confusions of identity. I saw you at the top of the stairs. Now I live a secret life. I saw you holding open the door. Now I'm filling pages with things I can't tell anyone. Now I'm more alone than I've ever been. I traded every beyond, every someday, for heaven in my lifetime. Now I'm dying of my life. Now I'm alive inside my death. You see this space between our bodies? Barely a hand, hardly a breath. It is the space mountains and rivers are made of. It is the beginning of oceans. The space between either and or. Both and neither. The happiness of forgetting our names and the happiness of hearing them for the first time. I heard you singing yourself to sleep. It was a song from both of our childhoods. And now I don't know if singing is a form of helplessness, time's architecture revealed, or some ancient motive all blood and breath obey to enact a savage wheel. I found you at dawn, sitting by the open kitchen window. You were sorting seeds in a plate. And if you were praying out loud, I'll never tell. And if you were listening to the doves, and if their various hooing and cooing and dying in time are your earliest questions blown back to you through the ragged seasons, and if you've lived your life in answer to those questions, I'll never tell. Your destiny is safe with me. Your childhood is safe with me. What you decide to bury is safe with me.
Thank you. That was Lee Young Lee reading a new work in progress, a love poem in progress, you called it. Thank you very much. I know that the image of seeds comes up for you again and again and again. What other images haunt you? You mentioned Jacob's wrestling the angels before.
Houses. I always dream about houses. You know, I'm always wandering around in houses, strange houses or houses from my childhood, you know. All kinds of houses. And sometimes they're furnished. Sometimes they're over-furnished. And sometimes they have very scary characters in the basement. Sometimes, you know, wonderful things. I'm always dreaming about houses. You know, and sometimes I'm trying to get into the house. Sometimes I'm trying to get out of a house, you know. But maybe I need help.
That's an image that haunts you. Are there images that you haunt, that you go back to again and again?
Yeah, I guess the same images that haunt me, I haunt. I can't tell who's doing the haunting, you know. Yeah, I don't know. And of course, the idea of lineage haunts me because I'm... it's dawning on me more and more that my personal lineage isn't my parents, that it goes beyond them and beyond and beyond and beyond and beyond, you know. That even parents somehow exist in a horizontal dimension.
What, let me ask you, what books are often by your bedside or wherever it is that you read or by a comfortable chair in your home, or what books do you carry around with you all the time?
You know, I'm reading a wonderful book. It's a little old, I guess, but I'm reading a book by Hannah. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right. Hannah Arendt, A-R-E-N-D-T, Arendt. Or It's called The Human Condition. I think it's a fascinating book. I'm reading a book by Ayn Rand, The Romantic Manifesto, which is amazing. I love both of those books. And I'm reading the poems of the other writers here at the Writers Conference, you know, Bridget Kelly and Terrence Hayes and Karen Volkman, and just wonderful books, you know.
You mentioned the Writers Conference that you're teaching mm-hmm. a workshop at. How do you combine writing poetry and teaching poetry? They're very different things, I think.
Yeah, you know, the thing that ties them together for me is I don't know what I'm doing in either case. You know? But, you know, it's okay to not know what you're doing when you're writing a poem because nobody's watching you, you know. And you can grope around for days and come up with three lines, and that seems acceptable. But in teaching, you can't grope around for 2 hours and not know what you're saying. And, you know, but maybe it's just my own mind, Shauna. I don't understand. For instance, on the one hand, I love thinking and talking about poetry with other poets. It's a great pleasure for me. You know, it's like drinking honey, you know, or sipping warm milk to talk about poetry with other poets. And yet there's a danger to it because it seems to me the more we talk about it, the more we articulate what it is we do, the more it becomes a hindrance to write the next poem, because I have to dismantle everything I know or think I know about poetry in order to write the next poem, mm-hmm. so that everything I come to a conclusion about hinders me from writing the next poem. So I'd rather not come to any conclusions. But then when you're in a workshop and you're talking to people, you're making statements about, you know, things like enjambment or stress or sentences. And it seems to me that all of those are provisional statements. But maybe that's the way to deal with it. You just let them know it's all provisional, you know. And but it's hard to convince oneself, you know, because they sound so good at the moment, you know. So it's hard, yeah.
You've mentioned also at various interviews that the most important act is the writing of the poem, not the publishing of the poem, that the publishing is very secondary, and said something to the effect that you, I don't know if it's the right word, but that poetry would create the same change by being written, even if it was never published. I don't know if change is the right word in there, but the same
yeah.
effect. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the publishing part, right, would be in that picture I tried to create of the poet being in a vertical state of affairs, in dialogue with their divinity or their daemon or whatever, and then the audience being on a horizontal dimension, the publication would be, would have something to do with the audience overhearing it. But, you know, I do recognize, too, that when we publish, it isn't just publishing. It's entering into a dialogue. I think the most interesting dialogue going on, for me anyway, is between poets. You know, and by dialogue, I mean publishing, you know. I think we could look at it like we could diminish it and say, oh, no, it's all about being famous. I think ultimately it isn't. I think that the paradigm for publishing is ultimately not trying to be famous. I think the real paradigm is this exchange, this dialogue. That's what publishing is. You know, it's a form of dialogue. But I do think that when we write a poem, that we change ourselves on a cellular level. I think when we read great poems out loud, especially, we change the way our bodies, the neurons in our brains fire. I think we change those, you know. And we can actually experience it when we read great poems. There's a felt experience of a change of consciousness. I mean, I feel it, you know, when I read great poems. I feel a kind of spaciousness in my head, a kind of, you know, openness, like new rooms opening in my head. I feel that, you know. I could, maybe I'm crazy, but so I have to assume that it's something's actually happening, you know, that neurons are firing differently. And so it seems to me that when we work on poems, that's already happening. So like Li Po, you know, he wrote his poems, he folded them up into paper boats, sent them down the river, you know. So I guess at some point, you can enter the dialogue or not, you know, but you've done your work. You've changed yourself. I think to change others is, I don't know, I feel complicated about that, you know. It would be like, if a person is like a country and a country is like a person, it would be like one country telling another country, well, you guys need to change, right? It just makes more sense for the country to change, you know, themselves. And for me, writing poems is a way to change myself, to make myself more open to my own inner dark and light and all that stuff, you know. But we know all this. I guess I'm stating the obvious. Yeah.
I think poets talk about this all the time. I'm not sure. I would imagine other artists do too, but I'm not sure about that. I know I once made a whole crowd of people that we have a group of friends that we have dinner with very often. And I said, oh, a line of poetry beats out anything. And they just looked at me like, what? You know, it's better than anything else.
Yeah.
It's sustenance in a way that nothing
yeah,
else is.
It is.
And so, no, I don't think you're repeating the obvious.
Oh, good.
I wanted to ask you if you had one more poem that you would like to share.
Sure. Sure, this is something else I'm working on. I don't have a title for it. It's about seeing my son when he was younger. He held a bird in his hand, and it was really hard for him to let it go. We had to convince him to let it go. The child wouldn't let go of the bird. As long as he closed it between both hands, two worlds, inside and outside, desire and wings, stayed one. Three worlds if you count the bird's fear, its pounding heart. 10 worlds if you count the trees breathing, 10,000 worlds because we dream, and all of them in hand and one, until the moment the thing set free flew beyond recovery. So what should the child have done? Held it closer? But closer was only close, and never the bird. Held it longer? What would he have kept himself from by keeping that little dust from falling upward into day's dustless rooms? Seeing his own falling. That's all.
That was a new poem in progress as well by Lee Young Lee about your son. Lee Young, very often we think about writers, that solitary image again of the writer, and yet you live surrounded by family, more family than most people live with. How do you put those two things together?
I'm just lucky, I guess. my family is wonderful, you know. I mean, of course, it's a trade-off, I guess. It's hard to, you know, sometimes I find that I'd rather just hang out with my wife and kids than read or be alone, you know. Being alone is not easy for me, and yet at the same time I crave it. And I mean, we eat together every night, you know. There's 11 of us, and we all congregate in on my mother's floor, my sister's part of the house, and we all cook and talk and eat, and it's a great experience for my children, you know, to have grown up that way. My grandmother used to live with us before she died, so there were 1, 2, 3, 4 generations in that house, you know. So my sons grew up with their great-grandmother, their grandmother, and their mother and father, and, you know, and so it was really a great experience, and they have a lot of uncles and aunts. And
let me ask you, is there any question that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you during the interview?
I can't think of anything. Thank you for asking, Shana.
Well, I very much appreciate you taking the time to be a guest on Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is Lee Young Lee, poet.
Thank you, Shana.
And this is Shana Ritter. Thank you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in June of 2004. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this and other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.